Cantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Dessert with Buddha by Roland Marullo. Narrated by Sean Renette. Life is this simple. We are living in a world that is absolutely transparent, and the divine is shining through it all the time. This is not just a nice story or a fable, it is true. Thomas Merton. I resolved to stop accumulating and begin the infinitely more serious and difficult work of wise distribution. Andrew Carnegie. 1. I sold our house, the four-bedroom gray clapboard cape where my late wife and I had lived together for 30 years and raised our 2 children, in the first week of March 2022. The headlines that week were filled with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, Putin's war, an undertaking so purely evil that every decent nation on earth condemned it. Like millions of others around the globe, I couldn't stop watching the TV reports and reading the stories online and in the newspapers. I couldn't help wishing that something, some miraculous intervention by the hand of fate or a merciful God, would put an end to the suffering, terror, and needless death. Different as they were in scope, those 2 events, the selling of our home and the invasion of a sovereign Ukraine, felt to me as though they were linked. Maybe that makes no sense. I'm obviously not saying that the pain I experienced at letting go of an enormous piece of our family history was in any way remotely equal to the dreadfulness of war, or that my suffering, if that's even the right word, was in any way remotely close to that of the Ukrainians. What linked the two was that both of them engendered in me a certain kind of resistance to the harsher realities of life, a not-so-subtle no, and heightened the sense of my own powerlessness against the forces of time and human evil. That interior no was like a sour tide washing up against what I thought was a solid, if recently constructed, spiritual rampart. For more than 15 years, my brother-in-law, the famous meditation master Volya Rinpoche, had been counseling me to say yes to things, to yield, to accept, to embrace a belief in forces larger than my own petty wants and preferences, to surrender. I thought I'd gotten fairly good at it. I'd recovered, more or less, from the crushing loss of my beloved wife, Jeannie. I'd gone on, kept living, kept trying, kept encouraging our children, Natasha and Anthony, to do the same. Time certainly didn't heal that wound, and I'm not sure it even softened the pain, but after a long period of sulking and self-pity, I realized the futility of saying no to Jeannie's death. I came to see that my stubborn resistance changed nothing and led only to bitterness. Day by day, with Rinpoche's help, I began to rebuild a healthy interior life from the ashes of my bereavement. I was doing fairly well at that, not interested in another relationship, but functioning. I spoke regularly with my children, mowed the lawn, raked the leaves, shoveled the snow. I played tennis and had drinks with friends. I made several trips to visit my sister and her husband, who were living on the family farm, now a meditation retreat in North Dakota, thousands of miles, and a universe away from my home in suburban New York. And then I realized it was time to sell the house. And then the face of evil was on the television every hour, and then the no that had been sleeping in the depths of my psyche was awakened. It circled in my thoughts, as impossible to ignore as an angry hornet caught in a screened-in porch on a summer afternoon. 2. Fortunately, my only sibling, her name is Cecilia, but I've always called her Cece, is a kind and caring soul, if a bit daffy at times. And, fortunately, she's married to the aforementioned famous Tibetan-Siberian monk Volya Rinpoche. Rinpoche, or Rinp, we always call him. Although I tried to hide this buzzing no of resistance and self-pity, Cece and Rinp must have sensed that selling the house would be painful for me, and they decided to make the long trip from North Dakota to Bronxville for what they called a goodbye visit. It was, as I mentioned, the first week of March 2022, and while the COVID beast that had haunted the planet for 2 years had not been conquered, it did seem that the virus and its various mutations were loosening their death grip on most of the country. With the exception of my magical brother-in-law, every adult in our family had contracted COVID before the vaccines were available, and, to different degrees, we'd all suffered. Cece had caught it from Shelsa, her teenage daughter, had gone into the hospital in Bismarck for 11 days, and nearly died. I'd managed to nurse the illness at home, but had been laid low for 2 miserable weeks. My daughter and son, 33 and 30 respectively, both of them in good shape and healthy, had shrugged it off after a few days of what Anthony called loginess, lost their sense of smell for another week, then returned to normal activity, as the medical people put it. Though what they'd returned to had been anything but normal. My brother-in-law had, of course, been unaffected. I say, of course, because over the years of our acquaintance, I'd come to believe that he was not exactly an ordinary human being. A Siberian-born sort of Buddhist monk with Tibetan lineage, a shaved head, the stocky, powerful build of an Olympic shot-putter, Rinpoche was ageless, occasionally maddening, always kind, consistently unpredictable, deeply goofy, and, for me, a gift from the universe. His teachings had been especially valuable during the previous months because I'd suffered from the repercussions of a cardiac ablation, 2 bouts of pericarditis, at the same time as I was wrestling with the decision to put my house on the market. The house where Jeannie and I had lived for 30 years, and where I'd watched her take her last breath. The house where we'd hoped to live together into old age. Needless to say, it wasn't an easy decision. I was still fairly young, barely into my 60s, and had good friends in the neighborhood. Friends, memories, deep roots. But the house is fairly large, and the emptiness of the place had begun to weigh on me. 8 solitary post-ablation weeks recovering on the living room couch had put an exclamation point on that emptiness. The kids weren't coming back, and the snow shoveling and lawn mowing and shrub trimming and window washing, well, much as I like to keep physically active, it was getting to be too large a part of my life. So I cleaned up the place and listed it with Miriam Puncharovsky, an old friend of Jeannie's and a well-respected realtor in those parts. In the early weeks of 2022, the market in Manhattan's swanky northern suburbs was, she said, hotter than jacuzzi water, Otto. And that proved to be an accurate assessment. 1 weekend of walkthroughs by appointment only. An asking price plus 20% cash offer from a young power couple, Ukrainian-Americans, as fate would have it, with a set of adorable 2-year-old twins. And the deed was done. Months earlier, pre-ablation, both my children had helped with the major clean-out and said their goodbyes. But Anthony was too busy at his North Carolina office to pay another visit, and Natasha, living in North Dakota and running the logistics of the meditation programs there, said she would be too sad. So I signed the papers without them, put a few of the more beloved pieces of furniture in storage, left some for the new arrivals, gave the rest away, and embraced the memories on my own. As soon as the purchase and sale agreement was signed, I fell into a mood slump. One of my many quirks is that I dislike the word depression and try never to use it, so I was glad when my eccentric sister and her more than eccentric husband said they were coming for a visit. "We want to say goodbye to the house, Otto," Cece wrote. But I knew that wasn't the real reason. Since Rinpoche considers air travel spiritually and environmentally harmful and generally avoids it, they rode the train from North Dakota, arriving 48 hours before the house was to be handed over. On my last full day there, Cece claimed somewhat mysteriously that Rinpoche had an errand to do, and offered to take me to lunch at a favorite Manhattan restaurant. The day was sunny and cold, typical of March in eastern New York. We walked to the Bronxville station, rode the commuter train to Grand Central, and strolled arm in arm to a six-table place on 9th Avenue. The walk itself was healing. I loved Manhattan, that intricate, frenetic palette of humanity spread across 22 square miles, and had loved it from my first glimpse. The faces and bodies and languages and architecture, the crowded sidewalks and rusty fire escapes, the endless variety of eateries. Decades earlier, I'd arrived as a North Dakota farm boy, landed an entry-level job at a publishing house that specialized in books about food, and slowly worked my way up to senior editor. I'd enjoyed a solid career there, made good friends, had a satisfying work life. In the last few years, part of the job had entailed sampling the borough's array of ethnic restaurants. I'd had a regular column on them, in fact, from the streets of my city, in a regional magazine. A place called Kabul on 9th had become one of my favorites. Cease and I found it unchanged. Mata, the Afghani owner, sat us at his only window table, tucked into an alcove 2 yards from the sidewalk. The three of us had a brief exchange about the war in Ukraine, which Mata said cuts with a big knife on an old scar for me. He left to convey our orders to the chef, and we sat in silence for a minute or two, watching New Yorkers trudge past the window in their overcoats and winter boots. "You're rich now," my sister said at last. I nodded somewhat guiltily. Jeannie and I had never cared about having a lot of money. We'd lived modestly in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood at first, very modestly, in fact, and then year by year money just seemed to accumulate. Two incomes, an exceedingly lucky house purchase, promotions, and all that in the era when the middle class had not yet started shrinking. We'd seen enough of America to know how high up we stood on the socioeconomic ladder and, at times, to wobble uncomfortably on that perch. My sister had cared even less about money and had lived even more modestly, at least until our parents were killed by a drunk driver and she and I realized that our plain old North Dakota farmland had become, in our absence, precious as sapphire. Cease had been beautiful in her youth, the object of many a farm boy's dreams, and had retained, even refined, her beauty into middle age. Her blonde hair was enlivened by streaks of gray, her wide-set sea-green eyes edged with wrinkles, but she exuded an open-hearted energy that made her seem younger than her years. There was, and always had been, something both sexual and non-sexual about that energy. A way she had of seeming to be fully present, deeply secure, a little wild, and completely unguarded. It gave me great pleasure that, after a string of boyfriends that covered the spectrum from decidedly odd to truly bizarre, she'd finally found in Volia Rinpoche the kind of partner she deserved. Cease had lived an unusual life, to put it kindly. For decades she'd scratched out a living reading palms and performing what she called past-life regressions from a small dilapidated bungalow half a mile from the center of Paterson, New Jersey. A flake, a nut, an empathetic but naive woman who'd lost touch with reality. That was the way I'd always thought of her, until she brought Rinpoche into my life. And then, too slowly, perhaps, I'd softened that assessment and started to appreciate and admire her the way I should have been doing all our lives. "COVID almost took you away," I said. She offered her lovely smile, nodded, sipped the yogurt drink. "Were you afraid?"
"Oh, no, Otto."
"Really?" Gasping for breath at first, then on a ventilator, knowing what you knew about the virus, and you weren't terrified? I had one bad night in the hospital after the ablation, and I was shaken. She tilted her head sideways and sent a puzzled look across the table. All these years of meditation, her expression seemed to say, all that time with Rinpoche, and you still don't understand that death is merely a passage? What she actually said was, "I haven't told this to anyone besides Rinpoche, Natasha, and Shelsa, but when I was really, really sick, when I really felt I might cross over into the other dimension, the strangest thing happened. I started to feel like my skin was a very thin barrier between me and this, I don't know, this air around me that was filled with all kinds of spirits, and all of them were, I don't know, rooting for me. Like they knew it was hard, like I was finishing a marathon or something, and they were cheering me on. Rinpoche always says it, you know, but this was like proof that a world of love exists right there, waiting for us, surrounding us. It was so comforting. It was the opposite of being afraid. I feel like I can accept dying so much easier now. Mine, his, yours, everyone's." Mata brought our food, a skewer of lamb with boiled herbed potatoes for me, and lentil soup and lavash bread for my meat-averse sister. "You're making that face like you don't believe me," she said, as she spread the napkin carefully on her lap, smoothing and patting it there as if it were a pet. Exactly what she'd done since she was a 5-year-old at Sunday dinner on the farm. "No, sorry, I believe you. I've learned how unwise it is not to believe you when you talk about things like that. I'm just jealous, that's all. After the procedure, I told you, I developed pericarditis, the first of 2 bouts with it. Big chest pain, impossible to take a deep breath. The first one lasted all night, and it scared me a little. I would have been terrified if I'd been as sick as you. You wouldn't have been, Otto." I nodded skeptically, started to eat. The lamb had been marinated and spiced to perfection. Cease loved the soup and made humming noises after each spoonful. Mata stopped by. We showered him with compliments, and I could see that even after all the years of rave reviews in person and in print, the kind words still reached him. He'd found his purpose in life, giving people pleasure at his tables. And finding your purpose, as Rinpoche had written in several of his books, was one of the 5 pillars of happiness. When Mata left us to greet a family of arriving diners, Cease offered another in a long series of stunning remarks, the kind of surprise she'd been pummeling me with for most of my adult life. No prologue, no diplomatic softening of the edges, only this. "Rinpoche and I want you to give away all the money you got from selling the house." From long experience, I'd learned it was better not to overreact. "You do," I said. She nodded 3 times, energetically, and napkined away a drop of soup from the tip of her chin. "You have plenty of other money, Otto. Your pension, the inheritance from Jeannie's family, her life insurance, your savings. Anthony's making a gigantic amount now, isn't he?" "He is. And Natasha lives with us, so she's fine. Rinpoche is giving talks again, or he's had inquiries at least. Though I've had this really strong feeling lately that he's nearing the end of his speaking engagements, the end of that stage of things. His books sold like crazy when people were stuck at home. Not surprised." Cease nodded. "How much did you get for the house?" "After Miriam's commission and taxes and so on, a little under $1 million. Another gleaming smile lit my sister's face. "And you don't need it, right? You're going to come live with us, aren't you, at the farm?" "Yes, thanks, only not in winter." She laughed. "You can travel in the winter if you want, but otherwise you have plenty of money and no place to spend it, right?" "I have too much money, yes, agreed, if there is such a thing." There is, she said happily, confidently, lovingly. "You have to give it away. You have to, my darling brother, to balance out all the selfishness in our country and in the world. Maybe set aside some for Tasha in case she wants a house of her own one day, and give away the rest. So many people need it." Jeannie and I were pretty generous with our charitable giving over the years. I've already written some big checks from the house money. HBCUs, Native American Heritage Foundation, food banks, the Perkins School for the Blind up in Boston, a fund for Ukrainian refugees that a friend of ours started the day the war began. I know, you've always been great that way, you and Jeannie. But I'm not talking about only writing checks to organizations or schools or like that. I'm talking about handing money to people. Quietly. In person. Changing their lives, like in a second. You can do that now. Not following, I said. She frowned as if I should have been following, or as if I should have been leading, should have come up with the idea myself before she thought of it, whatever the idea was. When we were on the train, Rinpoche mentioned a plan, and it clicked with me right away. I'm pretty sure I'd had a dream about it a few weeks earlier. He has to make a trip to Boston to see a special friend, and then he has a possible speaking invitation somewhere in North or South Carolina or Virginia, I don't remember. She also said she wants to join him at some point. I'm trying to arrange a couple of other things along the route. He said the two of you should take another one of your road trips. You could drive there, it's not that far, and as you go, just give money to people who need it. Carry a big wad. Exactly, Otto. The country needs something like that. There's too much greed, don't you agree? Too big a distance between the haves and have-nots. Think of what great karma it will be. I did agree, and I did consider the karmic aspect. For years I'd been troubled by our national cardinal sin, people making $100 million a year for shuffling money around or throwing a ball, while kids went hungry and too many adult Americans lived in poverty. In the second half of my life, I'd done a fair amount of volunteer work, tutoring mainly, helping young people from poor families learn to read and write well so they'd have a better chance in the job market. In the course of that tutoring, I'd spent time in some of the city's rougher neighborhoods, and in doing so, I'd come to see how easy it was, even in a jumble of a place like New York, to fall into your comfortable routine and avoid having to witness poverty up close. By accident, really, Jeannie and I had ended up in one of the wealthier suburbs, and it had given us a beautiful life. Excellent public schools, safe streets, markets selling healthy food, families who raised their children the way we raised ours, to be considerate citizens. I saw how easy it was, how natural, even, never to venture out of that luxurious bubble. Bronxville's restaurants, doctor's offices, shops, and tennis courts were all places we could get to on foot or by making a short drive. There was nothing wrong in living that way, nothing at all. Everyone in the country should have that kind of life. But the truth was that everyone didn't have that kind of life, and it was so very easy never to look at what we used to call the have-nots, never to go into their city neighborhoods or into the countryside, never to venture down the dirt roads where they lived. And that made it easy, on some subtle level, to pretend those people didn't really suffer, couldn't really be hungry. Even seeing them on the news, even visiting for a couple of hours to tutor kids in a school or community center, one could still sleep comfortably at night because hunger was invisible, and much of American poverty was hidden. So yes, we'd given generously to charity, and yes, I'd done some tutoring. Once the kids were old enough, Jeannie, a museum photographer by trade, had volunteered countless hours at the local retirement home. Still, from time to time, a voice whispered that we were inadvertently part of a greater injustice, accepting something that shouldn't have been accepted, the vast gulf between the overfilled and the hungry, the spoiled and the struggling, in the wealthiest nation on earth. During that conversation at the table for two on 9th Avenue, it was as if my sister, who'd lived so much closer to the edge than I had and for so many years, was peering into the place in me where that whispering voice periodically made its case. She was right. I didn't need more money. My children didn't need more money. I had and have no urge to drape us in the sticky cloak of guilt. We'd worked hard, lived good lives, been thoughtful citizens. But once I'd learned what the house would sell for, I'd realized in a fresh way how wealthy we were. My children were already insulated, both by their education and by the money we'd set aside for them, from any risk of ever being hungry. There was absolutely nothing in the way of material goods I longed to have. I'd continue sampling good restaurants, yes, and indulge my love of travel, but, and I knew Jeannie would have agreed, I wanted to push myself over a certain invisible line and into a level of generosity that made me slightly uncomfortable. I wanted to embrace the idea of enough, to live more simply, to take less for myself, and give the rest away in what seemed to me the wisest and most humane manner. It hadn't really occurred to me to do that with cash, or as part of a road trip with my brother-in-law. That was Cece's idea, and really no surprise. I sometimes wondered if she'd been put on earth to push her brother out of his complacency in all kinds of different ways. She'd introduced me to Rinpoche. She'd tricked me into taking the first road trip with him. Since then, at every juncture, she'd encouraged me to step out of my upper-middle-class comfort zone and explore the interior territory that she and Rinpoche both claimed made the idea of leaving this life less frightening. Only a fool would have failed to listen. On the train back to Bronxville, Cece had her eyes closed and was snoring quietly beside me. I looked out at the apartment buildings and bodega-lined streets of the Bronx and thought about possessions and money and the extremely temporary nature of both. I thought about my sister lying at the door of death, alone in a Bismarck hospital, about to be intubated, and feeling the opposite of fear. I thought about the pregnant Ukrainian women being carried out of a maternity hospital the Russians had shelled, holding their bellies as if their bloody hands and arms might protect the life within. It seemed to me then, as the train rocked and rattled into richer territory, forested hillsides, a golf course, a few large homes set back from clean streets and quaint villages, that Rinpoche had shown me a way to transcend the angst and fear and guilt and worry in myself. Like my bitterness and sorrow after Jeannie's death, that kind of mental activity helped no one, changed nothing. He'd shown me an elevated dry path out of that swamp and lifted me back onto it whenever I slipped off into the muck. It was less than a mile from the Bronxville train station to the house that would, in 24 hours, be the home of another lucky family. Cece and I walked up Hawthorne Road to Studio Lane, and there, 150 yards straight in front of us, set up on a rise behind a neat stone wall and two dormant white dogwoods, stood the house in question. The place where the Ringlings used to live. As we moved closer, walking not on the sidewalk but right down the middle of the quiet street, I noticed a new-looking silver pickup in the driveway. It was parked next to my dependable old charcoal-colored Camry, like the brighter of two siblings. Maybe the Krasenkos were already bringing over their belongings, I said. Nope, Cece replied. That's the truck Rinpoche just bought. The hybrid, he said he wanted, for the gas mileage. It's the one you'll be taking down south. I'll drive your car back to Dickinson, okay? Another stunning remark, another surprise delivered with her usual straightforwardness and innocence. Sure, fine, I said, forgetting to ask if her husband and I were going to head south for 1,000 miles, then turn around and drive all the way to North Dakota. I was too distracted. I was watching my bald-headed, maroon-robed, brown-skinned brother-in-law. He had a cloth or a towel in one hand and was wiping it across the brand-new pickup's headlights and grill carefully, tenderly, almost as if he were polishing the soul of a loved one. When he heard our footsteps, Rinpoche looked up and immediately erupted in one of his infectious skeins of laughter. "Otto, my brother and war," he said joyfully, evidently pleased at his own purchase, and having difficulty.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?